We here at Radio Boston are going to spend some time over the next few days reflecting back on some of the big events of the past year, and WBUR's Common Health blog has done the same thing in a post called Top Common Health Stories of 2011. Joining us now with a review of 2011 and to preview a bit of 2012 is Carrie Goldberg, co-host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thanks, Adam.
So before we get to Common Health's top stories, give us an overall picture of the year in healthcare. It's a rare area in which most of the stories have been kind of good.
Yes, I think that we all get very tired of bad news, and so I definitely like to emphasize the positive. And there have been some very exciting advances in healthcare this year. One in particular was kind of a surprise at the end of the year, which was that the renowned journal Science chose as its breakthrough of the year a study on HIV drugs. And it didn't get a lot of attention when it first came out in the New England Journal of Medicine this summer. It was a study that found that HIV drugs, known as antiretrovirals, which can sort of weaken the HIV virus, that they can be as effective as condoms in preventing transmission of the virus. I mean, you might think at first glance that, well, that's not that surprising, you know, the virus is weakened. But now, in retrospect, people are saying that this really could be an important, kind of the beginning of the end for AIDS.
It's a drug that prevents transmission in addition to treating the symptoms of the disease. That's really what the takeaway is.
Yes, that's right. So that was kind of the number one big story at the end of the year. And then if I may, I'll just rip through a few of the best headlines.
Sure.
Of the year. So there was also significant progress on the malaria vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And in a study in African children, it cut the risk of them getting malaria by about half. So that was more good news of great global importance. And then kind of on the side of things that don't affect many people, but they're very cool, there were those face transplants at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Yeah. That was the most popular story on WBUR.org this year.
Oh, that's interesting, because it had great visuals.
Yeah.
Right? It's like seeing how those faces were transformed is just incredible. Then there was yet another huge report clearing vaccines of any risk of causing autism, despite anything that the candidate Michelle Bachmann might say.
So that's been put to bed?
No, it's never put to bed, but basically, it was the most authoritative report so far.
So, Carrie, your blog post reviewing the top common health stories of 2011 is really kind of a listing of all the big stories with links back to the original reporting. What would you say is the top health-related story this year here in Massachusetts?
Well, definitely the top health-related story was, I would call it, health reform 2.0. You know, Massachusetts is so renowned for having brought in its near universal health insurance in 2006. And now we're heading toward cost containment. It's not enough to get everybody covered. We need to start beating down the costs.
And so the drama that we're seeing play out is really kind of a preview of where we can see the national debate happening in 4 to 5 years, because so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, doesn't really deal with cost control in the way that a lot of people had hoped.
Right. And so once again, it's kind of like all eyes are on Massachusetts, because the question is, now that we've brought in near universal health insurance, can we show that we can also bend the cost curve, as people say?
But the debate is now focusing around what they would call payment reform, that is changing the way that doctors are paid for their services.
Exactly right. So the way it works now is what's called fee for service, which means that doctors are paid for each little bit of care that they give you, which naturally gives them an incentive to give you more care. And the idea is that if you switch them over to a budget, an annual budget for each patient that's, of course, calibrated to how sick they are, then the incentive will be to keep them healthier and keep them out of the hospital and keep them better cared for without spending more money.
Well, along those lines, a lot of our reporting here at WBUR over the last year has been about trying to explain not just how, but why the costs are spiraling up so much. Remind us of a couple of those.
Right. Well, first of all, this year, WBUR launched a new sort of a social network site called Healthcare Savvy, run by WBUR's on-air reporter on healthcare, Martha Biebinger. And it's a place where people can share their experiences and even their costs, because part of the problem is that it's incredibly difficult to find out how much something is going to cost. And in fact, there were a couple of very interesting posts about about that. One was there was a woman who wanted to get her 14-month-old son circumcised. And when she called Mass General to find out how much it would be, they told her it would be $23,000 for a half-hour surgery. Another example was when the co-host of Common Health, Rachel Zimmerman, needed to get a fairly minor ultrasound procedure. She called around to hospitals and freestanding imaging centers and found that the difference was something like the cheapest place would be maybe $500 and the most expensive, which once again was Mass General, would be something more like $2,500.
And these were cases where we had people looking at not just their own out-of-pocket costs with their insurance, but trying to kind of find out what the thing actually costs the whole healthcare system. And there's some really, really shocking examples there. And I'm sure that we encourage people to continue to contribute to that effort into 2012.
Yes, absolutely. Because part of the problem is that there's no transparency. There's no, you know, public knowledge about costs. And so that's kind of been okay in the past when most of us didn't have to pay very much out of pocket. But as we tend to need to pay more and more, whether in deductibles or co-pays, it does become more and more important. And yet the information isn't there.
Well, aside from healthcare policy, which Common Health does devote a lot of screen space to, there were several interesting local stories about medical advancements or improvements happening just down the street in Longwood and elsewhere around here. Tell us about some of those.
Yes. Well, one of them takes place in a Cambridge biotech company called Vertex, where they've developed a really wonderful new drug for cystic fibrosis, which is a horrible genetic disease that often kills people very young, and actually almost always kills people very young. So Vertex has developed a drug that can all but cure. They don't call it a cure, but it really means a whole different life expectancy for the people with cystic fibrosis who can take it. The problem is that it's only about 4 or 5% of the people with cystic fibrosis who have the correct genetic mutation for it to be corrected by this drug. So it's a good news, bad news story. It's really an amazing scientific advancement, but it doesn't begin to help the majority of people with the disease.
Okay, well, in addition to looking back, this week Common Health asked some leading thinkers in the world of healthcare for their predictions about what would happen in 2012. So let's just talk about some of those.
Okay, well, so MIT economist Jonathan Gruber, who's one of the key designers of the state health reform law here, and by the way, who has a new book out that explains health reform in cartoon form, which is personally the form that I like it in best because it's so hard to understand. Anyway, he predicts that the Supreme Court will find that the major provisions of the federal health overhaul, which is known by many as Obamacare, including the controversial individual mandate, which means that basically everybody has to get health insurance, he thinks that the Supreme Court will find that constitutional in 2012. So he thinks it will be upheld. So we'll have to see if he's right on that. It could be wishful thinking. I don't know. And he also predicts that public support for healthcare reform will grow, which, I mean, it's already pretty high here in Massachusetts, actually, but I think the big challenge will be nationally.
I see here also that Josh Archambault, director of healthcare policy at the Pioneer Institute, predicts greater cost shifting from Medicare and Medicaid as federal and state budgets are cut, and he believes that cash-based prepaid private medical practices are going to start moving into the Boston market.
Yeah, that was a new prediction for me. I hadn't heard that one predicted by others before. We also have Paul Levy, who's the former head of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He says he doesn't think we'll find a cure for cancer next year, but he is encouraged by the advances that we're making in treating cancer, and he thinks that surgical errors will continue in 2012 because doctors stubbornly refuse to carry out pre-surgical checklists.
And finally here, I see that Star Lawrence, who is health and science reporter at healthsass.blogspot.com, predicted that the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which the critics call Obamacare, will be rejected in 2012. And she also humorously predicts that instead of dieting, everyone will get a government-supplied copy of Photoshop and call it a day.
Yes. She's really funny, actually. One of my favorite predictions of hers was that she said, you know, as health reform goes along and our doctors try harder and harder to keep us healthy, even when we're not in their offices, they're going to be nagging us a lot more. They're going to be calling us up to see if we took our pills and how we're feeling, or not the doctors, actually probably their staff. But anyway, so she predicts that all this solicitousness, like, you know, sending people to your house to assess your wellness, a nurse to call you about your pill taking, she says, will result in a booming sign and ringtone business saying, please leave me alone to die in peace. Thank you. Oh, and if I don't die, I will get back to you.
The problem is everything that leads up to that death is very expensive to the rest of society.
True. We would rather keep you alive.
Exactly. Yes. You can read more predictions on WBUR's Common Health blog. Common Health co-host Carrie Goldberg, thanks so much for prognosticating with us.
My pleasure, Adam.
And now some of your comments on our recent shows. Last Tuesday, we discussed the Tariq Mahana verdict after a jury convicted the Sudbury man of multiple terrorism-related charges for, among other things, translating Al-Qaeda texts and posting them to the internet. Frank writes at RadioBoston.org, Tariq expressed his views and did not attack America or hurt anyone. His conviction is an attack on American freedom. But commenter Jack didn't see it that way. He writes, at what point does a person become so dangerous to his community that the government has the right to intervene? When local children die in a suicide attack? This was an accident waiting to happen, and the legal system did right by preventing it. Also last week, we talked with Boston University professor Emily Rothman, who found that 1 in 13 Boston-area teenage girls she surveyed said that they had engaged in group sex, often without protection and often against their will.
65% told us that they'd been pressured or forced or coerced. That might have been anything from a boyfriend talking them into it, being given alcohol or drugs and being unable to consent, or someone using physical force.
Jan Dumas posted this comment online, any sex engaged against someone's will is rape. So the report should say that 7% of girls ages 14 to 20 have been raped. Now, we take the point, Jan, but this one slight correction. About a third of that 7% of girls who reported a group sex experience said that they did consent to it. Now, about that same conversation, listener Mike writes, the study's findings apply to the specific population studied, a self-selected group of poor urban youth who sought health care at community or school clinics. It would be a huge leap to apply the findings to the population at large. Finally, Slate technology columnist Farhad Manju came on our show to voice an opinion that is unpopular with local retailers, especially this time of year.
What I disagree with is the idea that if you buy books on Amazon, that you're somehow aiding this death of literary culture. I think that the main component of literary culture ought to be the reading of books. And there is no other company in the world that has aided reading books more than Amazon.
That caught the ear of Susanna Vazagou, founding staff member of Porter Square Books in Cambridge, which we mentioned in that segment. She writes, this whole subject could be discussed in the context of urban renewal. Our store is in a space that used to be a dress barn. Since we moved in, McDonald's is now Panera. Next door, there's a health shop. We have tables and chairs and Cafe Zing. We feel we had a lot to do with that. I don't think Amazon could take any credit, though, even if some of our customers come in and browse and then buy online. Listeners, you're welcome to browse our program anytime. You can listen to all of our past segments and post comments at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, a sister act out of Wellfleet comes to Symphony Hall for first night. We'll get a preview in our studio from the Parkington sisters, and they really are fantastic. I'm Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.